There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. Better world is coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world is coming, don't you see?
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you once again to Progressive News Network. Our show tonight, Women on the Barricade, Women Activists. I normally do a news segment at the top. I'm going to forgo it because there's this important speech I want you to hear Elizabeth Warren gave to the AFL-CIO. She really states the situation as it is. Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Elizabeth Warren in San Francisco in front of the AFL-CIO.
It is great to be able to be here with you, even if it is for too short a time. As Rich said, I was just in Washington for classified briefings on Syria. I'm headed right back to participate in the Senate debate and the vote on military intervention. But it was very important to me to be here with you today. So thank you for inviting me and thank you for making this possible. Thank you. Thank you. I also want to say to Rich Trumka, to my old friend Damon Silvers, to Steve Tolman, to Lou Mandarini, to all my friends from Massachusetts, to all of you who are here today, thank you for your hard work, and most of all, thank you for your friendship. I wouldn't be here today as the senior senator from Massachusetts without your extraordinary support. So thank you. Thank you. I also want to give a special shout out to the operating engineers, my brothers union. Woo! Way to go, guys. I just like to point out, my brother has a pension today because of your hard work. So thank you. That's what it means to be part of a union. You know, I love being here with labor. It reminds me of a family reunion. Lots of roughhousing, occasional arguments, plenty of food. But ultimately, in a family, we know we've got each other's backs. There's another reason I love being here with labor. When I'm here, I know I'm with people who stand up for working families across this country. It's true. Because here's the problem. When important decisions are being made in Washington, too often working families are ignored. From tax policy to retirement security, the voices of hardworking people get drowned out by powerful industries and well-financed front groups. Those with power fight to take care of themselves and to feed at the trough, even when it comes at the expense of giving working families a fair shot at a better future. This isn't new. Throughout our history, powerful interests have tried to capture Washington and rig the system in their favor. But we didn't roll over. At every turn, in every time of challenge, organized labor has been there, fighting on behalf of the American people. That's what we do. Now, at the beginning of the 20th century, when factories were death traps, when owners exploited workers and children, when robber barons amassed the kind of power and influence that made them think they were modern-day kings, the American people came together under the leadership of progressives to bring our nation back from the brink. And labor was there, leading the way. That's right. Labor was on the front lines to take children out of factories and put them in schools. Labor was there to give meaning to the words consumer protection by making our food and medicine safe. Labor was there to fight for minimum wages in states across this country. Powerful interests did everything they could to block reform. But our agenda was America's agenda, and we prevailed. A generation later, when our country was mired in a Great Depression, when people were on bread lines and looking for work, we fought back. We created jobs by investing in infrastructure and public works. We brought light and power to the poorest and most remote areas. We established federal laws on wages and hours. We enshrined into law the right to organize. We made, yes, we made banking boring and put real cops on the beat in Wall Street. And because we believed those in old age should not be mired in poverty, we created Social Security. All along that journey, labor was there leading the way. And once again, the powerful interests did everything they could to stop it. But our agenda was America's agenda, and we prevailed. When political injustice threatened to break our democracy, members of the labor movement were there, working for jobs and freedom, marching right alongside the Reverend Dr. King, fighting together for civil rights and the Voting Rights Act. When hardworking families were getting squeezed, labor was there fighting alongside our beloved Ted Kennedy. And now we have the Family and Medical Leave Act, and we have the Lilly Ledbetter Act, and we have continued to protect Medicare. That's what we do. And in 2008, when the economy crashed and it was time to rein in the financial predators and Wall Street banks, labor was there. You were there, standing shoulder to shoulder with me, standing with President Obama, and fighting for consumer protection. And you were. And thanks to your efforts, we now have a good, strong Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and we've got a director confirmed to lead it. That's your work. And by the way, just so everyone knows, that little agency has already returned $500 million to families who were cheated by big financial institutions. Yeah. Yeah. Not bad. It's helped tens of thousands of consumers solve their problems with big banks. It's out there working for us every single day. And this is how I see it. In every fight to build opportunity in this country, in every fight to level the playing field, in every fight for working families, we have been on the front lines because our agenda is America's agenda. That's why we're there. Let's be clear about this. We've always had to run uphill. We've had to fight for what we've achieved. Powerful interests have done everything they can to block reform. They attacked Social Security and Medicare. They attacked pensions and public employees. They attacked bank regulation and consumer protection. The powerful interests have attacked so many of the basic foundations that build a strong middle class. And too many times, they have prevailed. Even today, our work is uphill. The powerful interests fight us on every battlefield they can. Look at the increasing corporate capture of the federal courts. According to a recent study, listen to this one, the five conservative justices currently sitting on the United States Supreme Court are in the top 10 most pro-corporate justices in half a century. And Justices Alito and Roberts, are you ready, are number one and number two, the most anti-consumer justices in this entire time. The Chamber of Commerce is now a major player in the Supreme Court, and its win rate has risen to 70% of all the cases it supports. Think about this. You follow this pro-corporate trend to its logical conclusion, and sooner or later, you'll end up with a Supreme Court that functions as a wholly owned subsidiary of big business. Look at where we are on too big to fail. 5 years ago, experts said the banks have to be bailed out because there's too much concentration in banking, and the failure of one would bring down the entire economy. Now, The four biggest banks are 30% bigger than they were 5 years ago. The five largest banks in America now hold more than half of all the banking assets in the country. And because investors know that they are too big to fail, those banks get cheaper borrowing, which, according to one study, adds up to an annual $83 billion subsidy from taxpayers. Just another benefit of being too big to fail. Now, what about reform? The Dodd-Frank Act was an incredibly important achievement, but since it passed, the big banks and their army of lobbyists have fought every step of the way to delay, water down, block, or strike down regulations. When a new approach is proposed, like my bill with John McCain, Angus King, and Maria Cantwell to bring back Glass-Steagall, you know what happens. They throw everything they've got against it. And one more. Take a look at what's happening with trade deals. For big corporations, trade agreement time is like Christmas morning. They can get special gifts that they could never pass through Congress out in public. Because it's a trade deal, the negotiations are secret, and the big corporations can do their work behind closed doors. We've seen what happens here at home when our trading partners around the world are allowed to ignore worker rights, wages, and environmental rules. And from what I hear, Wall Street, pharmaceuticals, telecom, big polluters, outsourcers are all salivating at the chance to rig the upcoming trade deals in their favor. So here's the question. Why are trade deals secret? You know, I've actually heard people say they have to be secret because if the American people knew what was going on, they would be opposed. Think about that. Well, I believe that if people would be opposed to a particular trade agreement, then that trade agreement should not happen. Yeah. Yep. You bet. And finally, look what's happening in our states. Republican governors in Indiana and Michigan push for so-called right-to-work laws. And in Wisconsin, Scott Walker and the legislature he controls, yeah, have declared war on working families by ripping the guts out of collective bargaining agreements. The fight continues to rage, and the powerful interests continue to be guided by their age-old principle. I got mine, the rest of you are on your own. Well, we're guided by principle, too, and it's a simple idea, and all of you know it as an old labor idea. We all do better when we work together and invest in our future. That's what we believe. Yeah. We know that the economy grows when hardworking families can improve their lives. We know that the country gets stronger when we invest in helping people succeed. We know that our lives improve when we care for our neighbors. And we know that even though pundits and big corporate lobbyists in Washington might need to be dragged kicking and screaming, we know that America agrees with us. So here's the key part of what I want to talk about. On almost every issue of economic concern, our values are America's values, and our agenda is America's agenda. We believe that Wall Street needs stronger rules and tougher enforcement. Yeah, we believe that. And you know what? So do more than 80% of people. Wall Street will fight us, but the American people are on our side, and that's what we have to remember. This is it. We believe in raising the minimum wage. And here's the key. So do 71% of people. The Republicans will fight us, but the American people are on our side. We believe in preventing cuts to Social Security benefits. And so do 87% of Americans. The Washington insiders will fight us, but the American people are on our side. We believe in rebuilding our infrastructure and passing legislation to create jobs. And so do 75% of Americans. Yes, the Tea Party will fight us, but the American people are on our side. And we believe that the sequester is stupid. Yep. And you know what? A majority of Americans, including a majority of Republicans, agree with us on that one, too. Yep. We ought to be making smart choices about where to cut and where to invest. Washington will fight us, but the American people are on our side. You know, it was less than a year ago that the American people overwhelmingly reelected President Obama and gave us a mandate to fight for the middle class. We have a mandate. We have a mandate to build a fair tax code, one that isn't rigged to give breaks to big oil and billionaires while it crushes working families. We have a mandate to invest in the future, in infrastructure, in research and innovation, and in education. And we have a mandate to create jobs, jobs right here in America, jobs for hardworking people. That's right. So here's my message. Our agenda is America's agenda. The American people know that the system is rigged against them, and they want us to level the playing field. That's our mandate. That's what we're here to do. That's right. Now, I've already fought and lost my share of battles in Washington, and I've been around long enough to know Washington is a tough place. Real reform isn't easy. But I also know this. If we don't fight, we can't win. But if we fight, we will win. The budget, immigration, minimum wage, uphill battles, you bet. But however tough the challenge, however steep our climb, I am proud to stand with you, to march with you, to fight side by side with you. Our agenda is America's agenda. Let me hear it. Our agenda is America's agenda. And if we fight for it, we win. We win. We'll do this. Thank you. Thank you all.
That was Senator Elizabeth Warren, and a speech that you had to hear. Friends you know who need to hear it, make sure your friends know what that speech was about. Make sure they get a chance to listen. By the way, I put off tonight's news so that you could hear that, but the information I was going to be reading can be found at averyvoice.com. A-V-E-R-Y, averyvoice.com. It's my joke, Avery Voice. So averyvoice.com, you can see tonight's news. I urge you to definitely check it out. There's some important events coming up that you need to know about. And now, our next guest, you know, of course, this is Women on the Barricades, women activists, women leaders. And every guest tonight is a woman activist that you should know, that you should know about, and that you should support. And now, Laura Fazzone, president of Now of Brevard, and Vicky Impoco, activist and essayist. Two activists you need to know. And here they are.
This is Vicky Impoco and Laura Fazzone.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Welcome, ladies. Welcome.
Hi, Rick.
Hi there. You know, I have admired your work up there in Melbourne for some time. And I know that you're involved in so many important issues, peace activists, environmental activists, GM activists, human rights and women's rights. You know, there's so much to talk to you about. Let me first ask you to kind of introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now. May I ask you first, Laura, welcome.
Hi, Rick. My name is Laura Fasone, and I'm currently the president of the Brevard chapter of the National Organization for Women. And right now, we're working on our annual domestic violence prevention rally called Take Back the Night.
Excellent.
We do a lot of other things for women. We support Planned Parenthood. We try and work towards keeping religious freedoms, gay and lesbian freedoms, freedoms for women's reproductive health, race relations. I mean, you name it. Basically, if there's a woman involved, we work on it. So if, you know, basically anything that relates to women, and if men relate to women, then we are there for you too.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Vicki, let me ask you to talk about yourself for just a minute or two.
Okay. Vicki Impoco, engaged citizen. I'm involved with the Space Coast Progressive Alliance, Brevard Now, the South Brevard Democratic Women's Club, Move On, ACLU, the Peace Coalition of Brevard, again, multi-issues.
Well, I met you first through the progressive group and through a progressive caucus that has evolved into a progressive caucus for the Democratic Party many, many years ago. I've always admired your writing. You are an astute judge and an excellent wordsmith. And, you know, there's so many issues right now. Let me ask you both this question. You know, I know that both of you have been working at this stuff for a long time, and I'm not going to ask you how many years. But let me ask you this. When you first got involved, Laura first, what was the first issue that made you say, I have to work on this? This will not stand. I cannot just sit idly by. Could you talk about that for a few minutes?
Yeah, it was after my husband and I did a lot of chest thumping, high five, and major dance around the kitchen. I think that was election night of 2000, and when they announced that Al Gore won Florida, and we just were like a hooting and a hollering, and then all of a sudden they came back and they said, no, he didn't win Florida. And we said, we have to do something about it. So actually, we have George Bush to thank. Maybe it's Jeb Bush. One of the Bush family, the dynasty. We have them to thank. They spawned this monster.
That's great. How about you, Vicki? When did you get captured by the spirit of standing up for your rights and for your human rights?
Well, I'm going to date myself here, but it goes back to the Vietnam War.
You were only four.
No, I was. I moved to Florida in '67.
Today, yet another war.
Yep, I moved to Florida in '67, and I arrived in Miami and found myself attending what absolutely shocked me was a segregated high school. And when some of us confronted the band director and said, "You know, you can't do this. You can't isolate people anymore. You can't keep people segregated." And he said, "Well, it's like this. If you want to play in my band, that's the way it goes." And I said, "Well, I don't want to play in your band." And you know, this is while Dr. King is standing up for human rights in the streets, and so many people were treated so brutally. And at the same time, of course, Vietnam War, and many of us drew a direct line from the racism that was represented by the Vietnam War with the racism represented in the South. I was in. That's where I cut my chops too, so I can appreciate that. Let me ask you this, Vic. When the idea of green and environmentalism was seen by so many so shocking in the 70s, and part and parcel of that whole youth rebellion, when you see that distance we've come over these years, how do you stay positive? How do you stay positive when the battles of 100 years ago for women's access to reproductive health are again under question and being threatened? How do you stay positive?
Well, we try and make it fun. We use a lot of political satire up here, and sometimes that's the only way you can go on. One of my favorite activities and groups are the billionaires, and we've revived them many times. Billionaire Bush, healthcare, not welfare. What other ones have we
Well,
got?
We were billionaires for Romney this year, too.
Romney, for McCain.
Yeah, one of our better ones, lobbyists for McCain.
That was a priceless action.
I've seen some of those presentations. It's remarkable and very awe-inspiring, for sure.
And we didn't go to jail, so, you know, it was a win-win.
Yeah.
We had fun, we got our message out, and we didn't go to jail.
We show up in a lot of different costumes.
And we have our alter egos on that as well. We all have different names.
Sure.
I'm dressed
I was the Monsanto Reaper at a recent GMO anti-GMO rally.
I was a giant bee. We had protests for the ERA. We all wore period costumes. That one was fun too.
Absolutely.
You have to keep it interesting to keep others involved as well.
And in Brevard now, when you do something really, really good, we consider that that you get an award. And it isn't just an award. It's a tiara. So when we view something that somebody's done, we have to stop and think, was that tiara worthy? When you get your tiara, you become a real feminist in our group. And we all wore our tiaras to the National Now Conference with Terry O'Neill and Bonnie Grabenhoff and Hopper and everybody else. And they know us there, and they go, oh, there's Brevard Now. We wear our pink shirts and our tiaras. We have fun. We work hard, and we play hard. And that's basically how you do it. You have to enjoy what you do.
Well, you know, it's so important.
So it isn't just a negative. It's a positive.
It's so important. I recently attended a very serious conference where progressives came together and discussed, you know, working through the legislative process. And I can appreciate that, and there's certainly a place for that. And some people are mentally, emotionally, spiritually more comfortable working in that arena. And I was absolutely shocked to hear people say that street protest, that's passe, it's completely worthless, it shouldn't be indulged in, and these people who use theatrical methods. And I had to stand up and say, wait a minute here. We don't have the ability to pound our message across the television networks hour after hour after hour. We don't have all the paid spokesmen. We don't have the slick advertising. But what we have is that human integrity to stand on a corner and say, no, I oppose this. And I said, you know, having been a person who's done quite a bit of political theater over the last 40 years and stood on many, many a corner and had everything from a thumbs up to things thrown at me, I can tell you that my experience has been very positive standing in opposition to some of these glory wars that our country too often indulges in. Obviously, you ladies think that standing up for your rights, standing up sometimes on a street corner certainly using your wit and a little theatricality to get the message across, you find this is a productive method.
It is, and we attend all the town halls, all the county commission meetings, school board meetings, city council meetings. You'll see us in the audience, and
with our pink Now shirts on, they really hate when they see us come in. The politicians can spot us at the door, and they don't like it because we ask the hard questions. We're not afraid to ask it.
That's right. That's right. My wife and I, one time, it was announced that there was going to be a discussion at one of our child's schools about having uniforms. And my wife and I are not really enthusiastic about uniforms. We think that it's a fake solution to a real problem, and we wanted to go and oppose it. And we got there in time to hear we were there early, and the first speaker at the podium said, "Well, so do you want to have blue uniforms or green uniforms?" And my wife and I stood and said, "Well, wait a minute, where's the discussion about whether or not we're going to have them?" And they said, "Well, everybody agrees." And I said, "Well, I think until you have a discussion, then we don't know whether everybody agrees or not." And about half an hour later, it was discovered that, you know, everybody didn't agree. And that those people who were in favor of the sponsorship of the school uniforms, you know, they just didn't have the argument that they thought they did. I know recently you stood in opposition to GM Foods. Could you talk a little bit about the issue of GM Foods? I know many people are not really aware of how pervasive this problem of GM Foods is. Could you talk a little bit about that, whoever would prefer to?
Well, this is Laura. Well, you look at the fact that you have very little family farms anymore. You have very little really well-produced food. And in order to mass-produce the food on assembly lines, which is what basically these big corporate farms are, they have to use intense chemicals to kill off the insects, as well as to replenish the nutrients, because we literally are raping our dirt, our farmlands. You know, it used to be in the old days you'd give the back 40 some time to recover and then you'd move it to another area. We no longer do that. So we have given up in order to have things mass produced from a corporate level. We've given up good food, tasty food, nutritious food for food that's there every day. And so a lot of people say, well, see, we cut down on hunger, we bring the price down. Yes, if you want really good food, what they call organic food, you pay more for it, but it has better taste, it's healthier for you, it doesn't give you cancers, because no matter how hard you wash some of these vegetables, you're never going to get some of these pesticides off of it. And so that's one of the things there. Also, what they do to the meat. I was talking to one of my doctors, and I said, I think I'm giving up meat. And so he said, well, let's talk about it, because he said most Americans don't do vegetarians correctly. And he said, but I'll give you a piece of advice if you want to give up just one meat. He says, give up chicken. And I said, chicken, really? I thought that was the healthiest. He goes, that is the most unhealthy meat we have, because it is so ingested, full of antibiotics and growth hormones. He goes, think back 20, 30 years, the size of a chicken breast versus the size of a chicken breast now. And coincidentally, think back 30 years to the size of a breast on a 9-year-old girl, and look at a 9-year-old girl nowadays, because she's ingested all of this growth hormone via chicken.
What a lot of people also don't realize is when they talk about, you know, quote, improving these crops with genetic engineering, what they're doing, especially with the Roundup-oriented stuff, is they're making these things more tolerant so they can use even more pesticide than they could use otherwise. And a lot of people are left, unfortunately, because of the propaganda, with the impression that they're just trying to make these foods better. And as you pointed out, they may make them have a longer shelf life, or tomatoes with tougher skin, but that certainly has nothing to do with what they taste like, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Now, tell them about the bees.
Go ahead.
What happens when the bees go?
Yeah, we're in big trouble with the bees.
Yep.
Another concern is all the antibiotics they feed animals. That's one of the reasons we have all these resistant bacteria now.
That's right. And you're talking to an ICU nurse, and she deals with the MRSA viruses, or, you know, and resistant strains all the time. You know, if we're ingesting antibiotics every day in our food, when we get sick, antibiotics aren't going to work anymore, because our bodies have built up tolerances.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you about one of the contemporary topics that many people are talking about today. We've just recently seen the discussion of whether to bomb another country for peace and to help their citizens turn around in just a matter of a few days, to where now the president is saying maybe diplomacy is the way to go. Were you folks involved in that those discussions as well? Were you peace activists in this area as well?
Of course.
Actually, we had an emergency rally in Melbourne on Friday, September 6th. No war with Syria. And we had a great turnout. And we got good media coverage. And we had people of all walks of life, all political parties, all religions, all there standing up saying no.
And it was very noisy out on the street. People were lining up to honk their horns and jump out of their cars to support us. So I think we made Brevard County's voice heard, at least in Melbourne area.
You know, I got the distinct impression that the president was surprised that there was so much vehemence in opposition to his war plans. Did you get that same impression?
Well, personally, I was surprised by his plan. I mean, that's not what he campaigned for, a new direction in the Middle East and advocating for diplomacy, and a new war in Syria is not what we worked so hard for.
Yes.
And I realize a lot of this goes back to the Treaty of Versailles and the end of World War One and the mustard gas and everything else.
Sure.
And, you know, of course, with the war to end all wars, too, and, yeah, well, that worked. But, you know, I have a problem with chemical warfare as well, and I have a problem when Secretary Kerry stands there and says, all these children in these white shrouds, these white burial shrouds, and not one drop of blood. Well, I sat there and thought about that for a while, and I thought, why should I feel worse over a child in a burial shroud with no blood in a war zone as I do with a child in a burial shroud covered in blood? I mean, a death is death, war is war. And let's look at all the wars we've gotten involved with because we're just so good at helping out. Vietnam, that was a disaster. Iraq, well, need we say more. Afghanistan, that's coming around not. We're not doing very well in the Mideast. So, you know, we have all great intentions, and, you know, the road to hell is paved with them, and I just don't see where any of this is going to be a win-win. It just isn't. You know, we have a Congress that right before they left on their well-earned month-long vacation, we're talking about we have no money, we're going to be broke, we're going to shut down the government sometime in October, but yet we have all the money in the world to go to war.
Yeah, no sequester,
I mean,
for the
we
war
have
funds.
The money, I say, let's get Social Security up and running. Let's get Medicare up and running. Let's educate our children. Let's fix our roads, our bridges. Let's make sure that our children get decent education. Let's get health care for everybody. If we have this kind of money, apparently we do.
And we should concentrate our efforts not only on diplomacy, but a robust international humanitarian effort, and try and help the millions of refugees who are in Lebanon and Jordan and the 7 million displaced citizens in Syria. Just imagine all the lives that we could save by providing clean food or clean water and food and access to medical care.
You're absolutely right. I was involved in several discussions on Facebook with progressive activists who, it seems surprising to me, were so caught up in the necessity of us sending a message with missiles. And I said, to see this much enthusiasm, I would frankly rather see that enthusiasm about let's get resources to the refugees who are also adding to a destabilized Middle East. We've got refugees in Turkey, refugees in Jordan, in Lebanon.
Several children are there. Let's help those children. Not much we can do about the ones in the bloodless shrouds, but let's help the ones that escaped.
One other thing I wanted to ask you ladies about, and you know, like I said, I salute all the good works that you're doing. Many of us who are either in or entering the fifth and sixth and seventh decade of life are concerned that we make sure that we provide a good pathway to the younger members of our community, the 20-year-olds and the 30-year-olds, to get involved as they can. I imagine that now in Melbourne has a good set of programs to engage younger folks. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, like I said, we're going to do our fifth annual Take Back the Night Domestic Violence Awareness Rally. That's open to the public. We want everybody to come by. We're going to have people from the different task force agencies, everywhere from the shelters to the police to the, you know, different government agencies that work to help people, plus other events that we're going to have. Where we start helping all of humanity is when we start treating our women like human beings and less like chattel. When we no longer have to see in the paper that somebody was arrested because they beat their wife. When a woman never has to worry about having violence at the hand of a loved one and an intimate partner. It might not even be their domestic partner. It could be a child. It could be an uncle, you know. So as long as we, when we start treating our members of our own household as viable members of the human race, then we can take it a step further. But until we can do that, I have a problem going into another country. We can't even go into another neighborhood.
We're hooked up with several area high schools here, too. We have a number of interns who work on our various projects.
Excellent.
Mel Hawk, West Shore, Bayside, Palm Bay High School.
Also through FIT and UCF. So we're getting the word out. It's very difficult for a young mother that would have to probably pay a babysitter to come to a meeting, but it's amazing how many young moms are on our Facebook, or Brevard Now Facebook page, and they see what we're doing and they thank us. So we get the word out. We do definitely get the word out.
Well, ladies, thank you so much for joining me. Like I said, I can't salute you enough. You do wonderful work in so many arenas. Stick around for a couple more decades or three, huh? We need good people like you.
For Take Back Tonight, it's October 11th. That's a Friday evening from 6:30 to 9:30 over at Florida Institute of Technology, which is on University Boulevard in Melbourne. And anybody has any questions about it, they can go to www.brevardnow.org, and we'll get a link to them.
Okay, so that's...
send a letter to...
www.brevardnow.org. Excellent. Thanks again so much. Vicki and Laura.
Thanks for all you do, Rick.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. I really appreciate it.
My old friend, Rick. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies. Thank you so much, and I salute you. Have a good day, okay?
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was great. Laura Falzone and Vicki Impoco, two phenomenal progressive leaders from Brevard Now. Hello, is this Jenny? So that was the interview with Laura and Vicki. And now before I bring you the interview with Jennifer Wing, part of the Preserve Our Paradise, the folks on the West Coast in the Naples area who are about to be fracked, unless we all pitch in and get the word out. But before I do that, I want to mention our good fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart and her Wise Woman Media, Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report, Sita Beguil and the Sita Media Show, and Harriet Lehrman, the Voice of the People, and our good friend Rob Abston and his show Smile, It's Only Politics. So make sure you tune into these great progressive broadcasters. And now, Jennifer Wing of Preserve Our Paradise. Hello, is this Jenny?
This is.
Hello, Jenny. This is Rick Spisak, News Director of Progressive News Network. Jenny, good to talk to you. I know you guys just had a big meeting yesterday on the fracking issue of Naples. Why don't you give the audience a clue on what's been going on?
Well, we met with Environmental Protection, and they were trying to share with us their process of either denying or approving the permit that was granted to Dan Hughes' company. And so they were trying to enlighten our community of their process, and basically that they have a checklist that they have to go by, and if, and it's kind of a strict checklist according to them, and if the if their permit request meets all their criteria, that's been then they can approve the well, no matter, because it's not set up to take in through people's homes and the water and structure around it or anything. The statutes that are already in place, they don't, they've never had to include anything like that in the statute.
Okay. Now, there's been growing opposition. I know the good people of Naples have come together. They've called on their county officials. They've come on their, counted on their state officials to support them. What's the lay of the land right now? Is the county commission people, is there anyone on the side of stopping or slowing this fracking process down? Are you getting any support from some state officials?
The county commissioners wrote a letter to the FDEP asking them to really scrutinize and look at everything. Dwight Bullard is the only one who has written a letter and contacted them asking them to deny the permit. And that's it so far.
Well, that's good. He's a mm-hmm. good man. He's definitely doing some public good by supporting this. Where is that permitting process at this point? How many more check boxes do they have to sign off on before we hear one way or the other whether that process is going to be stopped or is it going to be one more giveaway?
They, I believe it is September 30th, they will release an intent to either approve or deny the well, and then I believe we have 21 days after that if it is approved for requesting a public hearing or something along those lines. I don't know the exact.
I don't want to be pessimistic. Did they give you much hope that they're going to have grounds to do anything other than approve it?
They just said that they have to make sure it meets the criteria. They said that this has been the first time there's been such a huge public outcry, and so that they're really scrutinizing everything. They said they've been sharpening their pencils, you know, going through boxes of pencils and everything, and they've received many letters, but that's the one thing I want to tell people is write them. They need to write them. And one thing I kind of overheard that I think is a great thing, that is the wetlands. This area is wetlands. There's cypress trees everywhere.
Right.
And everything, and they're saying that that drilling site is not wetlands. All around it is wetlands, but that drilling site specifically, and at one time it was considered wetlands, but they didn't have the Army Corps of Engineers go in there and say that it's not wetlands. And so I think that if enough people write the Army Corps of Engineers and ask them to, and contact them, and ask them to, hey, go over here and look and make sure that that's not wetlands or that it is wetlands. I believe, because if it is wetlands, they cannot approve the drilling permit.
So we're talking about two different entities, right? The Army Corps of Engineers. And do you know what the district the Corps of Engineers is? Is it, you know, District 5 or is it just the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, this particular office we need to address these letters to?
Yes. I believe it's in Jacksonville.
Okay.
I'm not 100% sure because this just came to me last night, and I kind of took a little breather today, and so I haven't done my full research yet.
What, are you trying to live a human life, too?
Yes. Yes.
Well, good for you.
So, a little bit. A little bit. But I think that's, when I heard that, I was like, wow, because the FDEP says, oh, it's not wetlands, but anytime you want to have a house built down here and it may be wetlands, you have to go to the Army Corps of Engineers and you have to pay them to come and survey the land and all that stuff. So it's quite a procedure, and you may not be able to build a house on your own land. So I think that this seems a reason to have the Army Corps of Engineers to come out here and check it out.
Okay, so the other process is FDEP. Or,
yep.
Okay, then that's the Florida Department of Environmental Protection?
Yes.
Okay, and is there a particular office we should direct this to? Is it the Office of Supervision of potentially destroying the environment, or is do you know what particular office that is? Or if you don't have it handy, what you can do is just email it to me, and I'll add this to the show later.
Yes.
Now, from what I understand, people kind of woke up one morning with a letter in their mailbox saying, "Oh, by the way, we'll be drilling 1,000 feet from your home. We want to know how we can let you know if things go really wrong." Are you one of the people that lives very close to this drilling site?
I am not one of the people who unfortunately received one of those letters, but I am in very close proximity to them.
Okay. Now, you know, many of us are aware of the fragile condition of the wetlands in the southern tip of Florida, from east to west coast. And it seems to me an obvious no-brainer that these are wetlands. If it's not particularly wet right now, it is the drainage system that takes water through the aquifer down to the Florida Bay. Did you, were Corps of Engineers personnel there at that meeting?
No, not at all. They weren't even notified. They weren't even asked anything.
Okay, so this was an FDEP meeting. What kind of attendance did you get?
People were in all night from about 5 until 9 in and out. I would say there was about 100 people at any given moment. Some people came and left. Some people stayed all night. But I would say it was a pretty good turnout.
That's good. Is the newspapers or television over on the West Coast, are they covering the story?
Yes.
Good. Good. I know at least there was at least some delay in the process already, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It's been slowed down a little bit. I guess they have a time restriction that they have to adhere to, and September 30th is the day.
Okay, September 30th. So we want to encourage people to send letters to FDEP. And also the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Jacksonville office to remind them that these are fragile wetlands and that we oppose the drilling there. Let me ask you another difficult question, it seems to me. Now, I know that there's an organization that kind of sprung up to oppose this. It's Preserve Our Paradise or something like that?
Yes.
Okay. Is there any other environmental group from the southwest part of the state who's getting engaged in this process, whether it be Sierra or Audubon or any other organization?
Yes, the Conservancy, the Sierra Club, and I believe I heard the Audubon. I don't want to misquote that, but I do know 100% the Conservancy and the Sierra.
Oh, that's great. That's great. We all have to pull together. Tell me, you and your family, are you on city water, county water, well water? What is your water source?
We are on well water.
Yes, as are so many here in Florida. When I moved from the southern tip of the state down in Homestead to the Stuart West Palm Beach area, literally the very week I arrived, I heard that there was going to be a county commission meeting to discuss growth in this county, Martin County. And I heard the stupidest thing I could ever imagine hearing. I heard a planner say the results of their study of Martin County is growth is unlimited. There is absolutely no limit whatsoever to building. And mm-hmm. When they ask for questions, I raise my hand. I've had the good fortune to do quite a bit of environmental research in my time, and I work very closely with environmental engineering companies. And so I said this. I said, you know, we've got a county where there's almost no city water. Almost everyone's got a straw in the ground with their own private well or two for mm-hmm. their lawns as well as their potable water. And also, most of these people, because they're not provided with any sewage system, are also on their same property. There's a septic tank. How mm-hmm. many septic tanks and wells can you put in the same ground?
Yeah.
And you'll be probably, unfortunately, not surprised to hear his answer, which was, well, that wasn't part of our study. So therefore, growth is unlimited. And
yes.
And that kind of tunnel vision is exactly what's been making Florida in desperate environmental straits. You know, I want to mm-hmm. thank you so much. Is there any final thoughts you want to leave with our audience about this issue?
Please write. It's imperative to write, whether you email or write a letter through the snail mail. Get it out to them. Write letters of concern. Why it's important to you. Why you believe it shouldn't happen. And facts. They need the facts. And write them. You can call if you'd like to call, but it's public record if you write.
Great. Well, Jennifer, I certainly appreciate you calling. It's a critical issue. I know for years I've been asking people, what do they hear about fracking in Florida? What do they hear about fracking in Florida? And they said, no, there's no way. There's no way you're going to frack in Florida. If possible, it'll be up in the northern part of the state. So you can imagine my shock when I heard that my good neighbors out in the southwest part of the state are in a situation where they've already put wells in, the land's already been sold, development's ready to go, and then you get this surprise note, hey, your water supply's about to be put in danger. Jennifer, mm-hmm. thank you so much. I certainly appreciate you calling in. Is there a website that people could come to support this, whether they make a donation or whatever?
Well, I know that there's Preserve Our Paradise .org, and then there's Preserve Our Paradise on Facebook.
Great.
They both have lots of information that they're giving out, and you can find stuff there. If you'd like to go to the petition on change.org, and I try to update it with all the new news releases and any addresses to write, and
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking the time from your life and from your family. We really appreciate it, and we'll make sure we get more voices supporting you in your effort to save and protect Southwest Florida. Thanks, Jennifer. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, for the information, all the details on who to contact and where to contact, go to averyvoice.com and scroll down past the news. You'll see the information on the fracking issue in southwestern Florida. And we have our first guest. Good evening. Welcome.
Hello, Rick.
Hello there. How are you?
Hi, it's Trish. How are you?
Very good, Trish. Very good, Trish. In just another moment, we're going to be joined by Amy Ritter, another wonderful progressive activist. And you can both tell us your stories. And There's so much you got going on, Trish. You've got the GMO food that you're working on. You can tell us about those events. And then also, we've got some news about some benefits that your band is going to do, too.
Yes.
Okay, let me bring Amy on. Amy, welcome.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure, Amy. It's our pleasure. Amy has done some really amazing work helping people understand who actually was voting our way. And Amy, could you just give us a minute about that rating the legislator project you worked on?
Yes, absolutely. So I worked for an organization called Florida Watch Action for the past 2 years, and every year during legislative session, we partnered with other progressive organizations, Progress Florida and America Votes, to come out with our middle-class champions list. And it was basically a list of the legislators who voted 100% for middle-class values in legislation. And then on the same on the other side of the spectrum, we also published the pink slip puppet list through Florida Watch Action. And so we let everybody know who the legislators were that were voting for the middle class, and also who the legislators were that were voting lock and step with Rick Scott. So we kind of were able to cover both ends of it and really let people know how their legislators were, you know, how they were voting up in Tallahassee.
That was a great project. And I understand now you're working with Scott Randolph?
Yes, now I am working for the Orange County Tax Collector, Scott Randolph, as his Director of Communications. And I am just so excited to be, you know, working with such an amazing, you know, leader and just a great boss. You know, Scott, I've admired him, you know, since he was my representative in the legislature. And I always joked that he was my moral compass when I couldn't understand the way a bill was explained. I would just look at their vote list and see how Scott voted, and I would figure out pretty quickly, you know, if I aligned my beliefs with that bill or not based on his vote. So I'm so glad to see him, you know, cleaning up the tax rolls in Orange County and, you know, making sure everybody's paying their fair share and just working really hard to provide quality service at the best value for taxpayers in the county. So it's an honor to work for him.
Oh, that's great. Trish, tell me, there are some really interesting events coming up. Why don't you tell us about what's new with the GM Foods and what's new with the wonderful organization GMO Florida. You were one of the co-founders.
Yes, thanks. I think importantly, I'd like to ask for everyone's support in our community to help us with our bill with Food and Water Watch. The bill is HB1, and it's been introduced from Rep. Michelle Ruwinkle-Vazalinda, co-sponsored by Pafford. And so far, I think we have almost 20,000 signatures. And so our goal is to get labeling in the state of Florida, just like Connecticut and like Maine. And so please, if everyone can call, visit, write your senators and your representatives and ask them to co-sponsor HB1, that would be amazing. And
excellent.
Voting takes place. Yeah, the voting takes place now between September, sometime around now, until March 2014. So if our constituents get pressure from us, more of them will co-sponsor these bills. So that's one thing. Senator Sachs, she will be reintroducing our bill from the last session into the next session. So when that comes along, you know, please look out for that. Right now, we have the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Be on the lookout for a letter coming in, either by email or by mail, by sometime around September 21st. And it's a secret transatlantic deal in which there's no transparency, and it's designed to destroy labeling laws, to sway the European Commission to allow for GMOs, to help corporations overturn current labeling laws, calling labels a barrier to foreign trade, and the U.S. State Department is hell-bent on pushing GMOs. So what we want to say is to our Congress, do not allow the president to fast-track these secret trade agreements. Tell Congress, keep your constitutional authority. We want a democratic process, and we want full transparency. End the fast track to push the secret trade partnership. And our Congress has the power to do this. So we just want to let them know we care about this, and they shouldn't be passing secret trade agreements, you know, especially in regard to our food supply, you know. So that's
we've had a couple presentations. We've had a couple presentations on that issue, and it's going to be the big fight of the fall. And
sure.
You can't be lost. Wow, you've given us some really good action items. It sounds like you got some more, too.
A couple more. I know we're short on time. So basically the Monsanto rider that everyone's been so upset about has been extended without voting on it. So that's a terrible extension to our farm bill, allowing Monsanto pretty much free reign and to be above the law. So Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon has a bill. Look out for that and, you know, try to support any way you can. That reminds me that in Washington, state voters will decide on their bill. It's Proposition number 522, and that will be voted on in November. So Monsanto, FYI, has given $4.6 million on, to the No on 522 campaign. So if you want to, right?
Yes, one corporation, 10 million votes.
Right. So if you want to support, if you want to help out, please, you know, Google yes on 522 for more information. Then basically, you know, a couple things have happened with our food supply recently. Number one, we've found that these secret wheat, genetically modified wheat trials had accidentally leaked into a farm in Oregon. Okay, so that's really scary. And the science behind the wheat is that it can be very detrimental for liver failure in children. And, you know, so, you know, the fact that it's infiltrated, I mean, these are crops that have pollen, so it's no wonder, you know, that they've infiltrated other crops. And then just recently, alfalfa has been detected in a field in Washington that was intended for the UK. And as you know, 64-plus countries have a ban or mandatory labeling of GMOs. So this is going to hurt our farmers if we can't trade, you know. So instead of the TPP, you know, I think what I'm trying to say is that we need to get rid of the GMOs and that are destroying our farmers in this country. You know, this is our alfalfa crop. It's for our animals and our dairy. And so it's a shame to see that, the infiltration happens.
They've sued farmers because some of their genetics crop has shown up in farmers' crops, and yet we see these sudden spring up of GM crops, and you know, of course, they're going to turn around and blame the farmer somehow. Hey, it's not the farmer who's spreading GM seeds, by the way, and you're right. The TPP is only going to make all of that far easier. So we've got a full plate to fight. Thanks so much for this information.
Absolutely.
Now, I also understand that not only is your GM your GMO activity hot and just skyrocketing, also it seems that you're doing some benefits with your band too.
Thanks. Yeah, we're doing some benefits for the band. We have World Food Day coming in October, which will have a lot of great artists and speakers. And this is October 12th from 1 to 4 p.m. And we also have coming up next week on Friday, this is the benefit for Rick O'Berry's Dolphin Project, in which we're playing with Bob Ingram and Jim Worster, Diane Ward, and a lot of great artists. So this is in support of Rick O'Berry's Dolphin Project. The money goes toward his project, and we're doing some Fred Neil tunes. And basically, the Dolphin Project is an international organization that's dedicated to restoring freedom for captive dolphins and whales. So, and Rick O'Berry is, you know, if you've seen the documentary,
he's been in the dolphin field for a long time. That's for sure.
Right.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
So the O'Berry thing is next Friday?
Friday, yes. It's at Luna Star Cafe.
Luna Star Cafe. That's North Miami, right?
It is. It's Miami. Yeah, it's 775 Northeast 125th Street in Miami.
Good, good. Lovely place. A lot of good music there.
Good Trish.
If I'm not mistaken, I think we have a couple tunes here of yours. Would you rather hear Hold My Hand first or Starlight? And which one? Let us know and set it up.
Sure. Let's play Starlight. Right now, Starlight's on 220 radio stations across the country, and we're really thankful for the airplay. And I'd like to thank everyone who's helped us with World Food Day, all of our volunteers, with our 30 groups across the state, everyone that's helping to get the word out, and everyone who's been supporting the band. And thank you for allowing us to have a place to speak. So I really appreciate everything you do, and thank you so much.
Well, you do a lot of good in a lot of arenas, so the least I can do is help you get the word out. So this is Trish Sheldon. Your band is called Sky Drive,
right? Blue Sky Drive.
Blue Sky Drive?
Yes.
Here we go.
Must have been dreaming, wasn't believing.
A lovely tune. Tell me, Trish, when you advise families on how to steer as clear as possible from GM foods in the typical grocery store, what kind of advice do you give people?
Sure. Let's get back to basics. Look at the ingredients. Avoid processed, packaged foods. Don't give your kids cereal. Make them eggs and vegetables or fruit. Stay away from the subsidy crops, corn, soy, canola oil, cottonseed oil, sugar, from sugar beets, now alfalfa, things like that. So really start reading the label. If you can't pronounce it, this is just common sense. Don't put it in your body. And, anything in a box, in a bag, 86% of all items on our grocery store shelf have some form of a genetically modified organism. Some cases, a bag of Lay's potato chips may have five different kinds, or Doritos. may have five, you know, four or five different kinds of GMOs in one bag.
Let me ask you this. Is there any way of judging, you know, when you go, for example, you know, lots of folks enjoy tacos and the typical Mexican plates. Are you more likely to get GM corn in a, should we say, a more packaged product, or are you more likely to get it in a more, you know, say something shipped here from Mexico?
Right. There has been infiltration in Mexico corn. I say that, you know, when it comes to any kind of corn chips and you're out at a restaurant, you just have no idea. Sure, if it comes from another country, the possibility is probably better that there's not GMOs in it, you know. However, you know, we're dealing with pollen and cross-pollination, so it's very hard to tell. I would say blue corn may be a little more advantageous, especially if it's organic and if it has the non-GMO Project Verified label on it. If you're going to do corn chips of any kind, look for those two labels on it, and there's a better chance that there's no GMOs in it. You know, I say avoid the chips if you're out at a restaurant and you just don't know.
Hey, Trish, this is Amy. This is so fascinating. As someone who doesn't really cook and eats out so much, hearing this list is so helpful to me. So would you say that chips are, you know, when you're out, would be the number one thing to look out for? I know earlier on the show we had Laura and Vicky talk about chicken. It would be the one meat to stay away from if you had to pick one thing. So I guess my question is, for someone that, you know, maybe doesn't cook a lot, like myself, eats out, what would you say is, like, the one or two things just to definitely stay steered clear from? Like, easy changes we can make to our diet.
Sure. Chips. Absolutely. Anything that's overly processed, you know, salad dressings are all soybean oil, you know, the majority of them, or canola oil. So our dressings, mayonnaise, chips, crackers, things like that, anything processed, and if it takes more than three or four ingredients, you know, then definitely steer clear. And that's why it's so important, the restaurants that we go to. Why don't you seek out your local organic restaurants and give them your business, and because they have your health interest in mind, you know. And when the other restaurants start to realize that less people are going, what's happening, you know, if we talk to our store managers, we can tell them, look, I can't support you anymore. I need to have better ingredients or things like that. Open their minds a little, and then they'll start to change too. And so we can create the tipping point together by where we put our dollars or where we don't put them.
You know, that's such a great idea. I wonder if there's any kind of resource out there, if we just need to start, you know, being more aware of restaurants that we go to and, you know, maybe making a list that we can find online or
maybe an app or something. Local Harvest, you can go to localharvest.org, and sometimes Happy Cow will have some listings, and any search for organic in your area, and then and we'll help keep those businesses alive, and then we'll help keep our organic farmers going. Because remember, our organic farmers have to jump through major hoops, 10 years of soil certification in order to bring us this organic, whereas regular conventional crops or the GMO subsidy crops, we have no idea what's in the soil, absolutely none. But so it's definitely will create the tipping point, you know, going out of our way to support companies like, if you want pizza, go to Pizza Fusion. I think even the Mellow Mushroom has some organic and gluten-free options, you know. So just simple choices like that, you know. And I know it's driving a little further out of the way, but eventually we'll have more of resources in our own backyards just based on this.
Absolutely. This is a great place to start. Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we play a little bit more of another tune? How about Hold My Hand, Trish? Who wrote this?
Thanks. Lisa and I wrote the song, and I basically was thinking just tough times and how friends can pull us together in these times, and being there for people that you care about in your life when they're having a rough moment.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Trish.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm going to put this lovely tune on. Folks, check out this lovely band, Blue Sky Drive, and support them when they do these wonderful benefits. Thanks again, Trish. Thanks for everything.
Thank you very much. Take care. World Food Day 2013.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to bring on the charming and talented Dr. Rachel Pienta. Dr. Rachel, we also have Amy Ritter with us. How are you doing tonight?
I'm great, and I'm really excited that Amy's joining us tonight. That's awesome.
Well,
hey,
you're
Rachel,
two both,
how are you?
Good,
two
how are you?
Very special ladies. Rachel, Amy's got some questions for you.
Perfect.
Yes. I have been doing some research on you, Rachel, and it seems like you are quite the busy woman lately. So I guess I'd like to start with your upcoming race. So you are running for the second vice president position for the Democratic Women's Club of Florida, right?
Yes, I am. I am a late addition to the slate. They had an opening for the second vice president position, and I got a call a few weeks ago asking if I would fill that spot. And I said it would be an honor and a privilege to run on the same slate as Dr. Maureen McKenna. I've had the honor to work with her the last couple of years in my role as communications chair. She was first the legislative chair and then later became first vice president of Democratic Women's Club. And now she's running for the president. So when she called, it was basically an offer I could not refuse.
No, that sounds great. And so I guess, you know, if you could just explain to us how you got involved in politics and, you know, specifically women's studies and women issues and, you know, where your journey has taken you to, you know, running for a statewide position with the Democratic Women's Club.
Oh, gosh. I probably first got interested way back in high school, and I don't know that we want to go back that far. But
go ahead.
But
we're students of history.
Right, yeah, the more recent history, gosh. I came to Tallahassee for graduate school and was fortunate enough to have a paid fellowship with the Florida House of Representatives to work on the Committee on Education K-12, and that paid for a large majority of my master's degree. And while I was at Florida State University getting courses in education, I was also able to take a lot of classes in women's studies. And I got involved in the local activist community in the Tallahassee area. I was a victim advocate responding to rape crisis calls for Refuge House, a domestic violence, rape crisis violence center in Tallahassee. And I spent 4 years doing that while I was in graduate school. I finished my fellowship, finished my master's degree, and started a PhD in educational leadership and policy studies, and also did a specialization in women's studies. So And while I was doing that, I had boots on the ground experience working on women's issues. I was carrying a beeper and responding to calls with rape victims at the local hospital, and meeting other women leaders in the community. And of course, being in the Tallahassee community, I had some really great role models in this area, like Marjorie Turnbull and Loranne Owsley. And they were just really, really good people to have to look up to and say what strong women can do in a community and what opportunities for women in politics there are in Florida. And these were the people I got to spend some time with while I was in graduate school and trying to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I was, so far, I've been fortunate enough to live in the Tallahassee area, even though I work for Valdosta State. So I actually work for a college about an hour north of where I live, but I still stay in the Tallahassee area, and that lets me have a foot in both Georgia and Florida. And I've been able to have some great opportunities along the way. I went to Washington to intern in Congress for a while, actually with Congresswoman Karen Thurman when she was a congresswoman. And those experiences really have kind of informed my practice as a writer and a teacher, and then, of course, in my role as someone who's politically active in the community.
Absolutely. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, as somebody who is, you know, running for a position, a statewide position, you know, within the Democratic Women's Club, you know, somebody that's obviously had an immense amount of education on women's studies and issues, and who, you know, is politically active, you know, what are your thoughts about, you know, women running for office? You know, I, of course, we all know that there's different kinds of obstacles for women running for office, but I wanted to know what your take was on it, since you do have such an extensive, you know, education and background on, you know, women's studies and women's issues.
One thing I noticed over the years, as I'm sure you have too, Amy, is that so few women run for office. I mean, I was fortunate to connect with some strong women leaders early. I got to work on Karen Thurman's second campaign for Congress and then go intern with her. And then I knew some great women leaders in Tallahassee, but they're actually far and few between. And so the fact that, you know, I can name these names is great, but there are many more men's names we can name, and that is sort of sort of an impression that I have always had, that it was always about men. When I, in between undergrad and graduate school, I went over to London and I studied overseas with a member of parliament. And when I came back, he actually had done a tour in the States, and he came and spoke at the university where I was. And I went up to him and said, hey, I interned and took this intensive course with you last year. And he's like, oh, great. What are you up to? And I said, oh, I'm finishing my degree. I'm going to graduate school. And he's like, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I was thinking I was going to teach for a while. And he's like, oh, great. That's awesome. And I said, well, I won't do it forever. And he's like, oh, right, because you're going to get married and have kids. And I said, well, no, I was thinking I might run for office. And he's like, oh, okay. So, this was the early 90s, and I was just kind of struck by this, like, what? You were a teacher. You worked for,
yeah.
And then you became a legislator, and you worked for Margaret Thatcher, but you're telling me I'm supposed to get married and have babies? What?
Wow. So do you think the issue is that just women are just maybe, you know, we need to be asked more, we need to be empowered more, you know, more, support each other more, and maybe just go out there and do it and don't, you know, expect, you know, men to fill these positions all the time. I mean, as women, we need to be out there strong, standing up for our rights and the rights of everybody as well, right?
Well, we absolutely do, Amy. And one of the reasons that I'm part of the Democratic Women's Club of Florida is because the organization was formed to support other women running for office. And that's really led me down a couple of other roads, this idea that women can help other women, and that really it often takes women helping other women to make it happen. I've been fortunate the last 2 years to be part of a group working on a Knight Foundation grant. It's a Women Can Run grant. And I was a founding member of the Oasis Center for Women and Girls in Tallahassee, and I've been working with the executive director, Haley Cutler, on this grant. And we have been able to, in the first year, we put together a day-long seminar and we wrote a campaign manual. This year, we're actually doing, every other month, we're doing a big public Women Can Run event with a specific focus about running for office. We also accepted 6 women into a cohort that are going to get intensive campaign training from campaign experts and specialists who've run real successful campaigns statewide. And they're getting that for a very low price, and they were chosen in an intensive process where they had to apply and be vetted and be awarded to do this.
That's incredibly exciting to think that there are 6 women out there that are being trained extensively to run for office. Of course, I wish there was more, but this is a great start. I'm really excited to see, you know, this program, Women Can Run. Is that what the
Women
the
Can
is?
Run, and it is a joint project from Oasis Center for Girls and the Tallahassee Leon Commission on the Status of Women. And we were being funded by the Knight Foundation. We got approval to cover a 4-county area in North Florida. So that's Leon, Wakulla, Gadsden, and Jefferson County. And so we do have women across the 4-county region who have been accepted to this. And it's a diverse group in age as well as race and life experience. So that's really exciting. And we're getting a lot of inquiries from around the state of Florida about how they can replicate our program. So that's also really exciting.
Wow, I'd love to see something like that in Central Florida where I'm at. And so, you know, I wanted to ask your take on, you know, the upcoming governor's race. I know that we have a female candidate, former Senator Manbritt, who's in the race, and, you know, there's talks about Alex Sink jumping back in, talks about Charlie, talks about Rick Scott, you know, fundraising and being a formidable candidate, as awful as that is for me to think about and have to say. You know, and also, you know, Bill Nelson is a potential candidate as well. I mean, I was just wondering what your take was on this upcoming governor's race and what you think what we could hope for.
Well, I do want to show my appreciation for Nan Rich for being out there on the campaign trail early and being a voice for the change we need in Florida. So I do wish Nan the best in what I think is going to be, if not a crowded primary, at least a competitive primary. The next month is going to be really interesting for Democrats in Florida to watch. I do expect at least 2 more candidates to get in by the end of October. And I really am excited by the possibility that we could have 2 legitimate established women leaders on a primary ballot for the Democratic nomination for governor. That is, that's big for Florida. We haven't had a woman governor. Yes.
Rachel, let me ask you a question. You know, whether the skepticism for Ms. Rich's candidacy is because she's a progressive or because she's a woman, how much of that do you think is just raw sexism?
I'm glad you asked that question. In this case, I actually don't think it's sexism. I really think that not that women are not subject to sexism in politics. It's still very real. It's still very much there. But in terms of legitimate women candidates getting some respect, I don't think that the challenges that Senator Rich has faced on the campaign trail are about the fact that she's a woman. Maybe because she's a progressive in Florida, but also because Florida is very fickle about Democratic Florida in particular, very fickle about our candidates and who we decide to back and support. And we tend to like political rock stars whose, you know, fires burn very hot and bright. They might not have the most staying power, but often that's who we sort of attach our political hopes and dreams to. And we have a record of that. And the rock star effect in Florida cannot be discounted. And could it be sexism that we haven't had a lot of Democratic women rock stars? Institutionalized sexism, yes, absolutely, because it's hard for a woman in politics in Florida, anywhere really, to have that kind of traction. But we have women, good Democratic women rock stars in other states. People that, when I say rock star, I'm talking about a Kirsten Gillibrand, a Tammy Duckworth, someone like that. They're legitimately Democratic women rock stars who are respected, have a lot of traction. It's really hard to name too many of them in the Democratic Party in Florida. I mean, we've got a Debbie Wasserman Schultz. There's a very bright star, but we don't have a lot of those type of women. I really like Kathy Castor, but she's not talking about running for governor.
Can I ask you one more question about the governor's race? I'm I'm puzzled, having observed the Democratic Party in Florida relatively closely the last decade. We know in the past there was a great deal of centralized control and decision-making. And do you think we're moving in a new direction finally?
Oh, wait. When was this era of centralized control and decision-making? Are you talking about Florida Democratic Party?
Well, let's just say I saw an awful lot of king-making in the old days. And I'm wondering if we're hopefully moving away from that, but from the tone of your voice.
Let me ask you this. When do you think the king-making happened? Let's name years and maybe even names, because I'm wondering about your perception.
I'm thinking that, you know, basically from the 20s or 30s on, the era of smoky backroom politics, you know, there were promises of something better in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And seeing the previous administration, I'm still hopeful that the new administration we have now.
I don't think we have Democratic kingmaking since Dempsey Barron was in power. So, I mean, the long, slow slide of the Democratic Party, people
Graham,
think
Graham
in the
and Childs, you know, you don't think those – well, obviously you have a different perspective than I do. So.
I do. I mean, I think that Bob Graham, when he ran for governor, didn't necessarily expect to win the gubernatorial race. He didn't. And when you have a Lawton Childs, who was considered actually a long shot in his first race as well, and people thought that Jeb Bush was going to knock him off the first time Jeb Bush ran against him. So I don't know about this whole king-making thing. I think that we've had Democratic primaries, let's say that, with strong, viable candidates.
Well, I hope to see that again.
And I think that that's actually part of the problem, is that we used to actually have strong leaders competing to be governor. And that's what we haven't seen recently, is that we have not been building our backbench to the point where we've got a bunch of governors in waiting who are actually going to step up to the plate and compete with each other. So what do we have this year? We have governors in watching. Who are watching, they're watching to see everybody else's move, and that's why I'm telling you the month of October is going to be really interesting, because it's who's going to pull the trigger in October before the Florida Democratic Party state convention.
That's true. Anybody willing to place any bets, Rick, Rachel?
I've been hearing people place bets. I'm waiting for Kevin Cade to start a pool. If Kevin Griffin needs to start his betting pool on who announces first, Charlie or Alex?
My bet's on Alex. I'm just going to call it right now. I feel like she's going to be the first one out the gate to announce in October, for sure.
Well, I think that Charlie Crist and Alex Sink will announce in October. It's just which day in October.
That's a little too specific. I think Alex will probably announce first. That's just my bet. That's what I'm going with. So we'll see what happens. So I'm curious about, you know, what the Democratic Women's Club is doing as far as, you're running for the statewide race, and Maureen McKenna is running for president, and you're supporting her as well. Do you all have a platform, anything that you're specifically going to be focusing on next year? Are you getting involved in the governor's race? Are you, you know, pushing for legislation? Are you against specific bills? What is the Democratic Women's Club up to, I guess?
Well, I'll tell you that it's a little early for us to be talking about specific legislation, because we're coming up on the first committee weeks for the legislature. So what we know so far is that we are going to, of course, be supporting Equal Rights Amendment legislation, and Arthena Joyner and Lori Berman just co-filed that legislation this past week. So the ERA is always a big push for us, and we'll bring that back to Tallahassee again this fall, and we'll be supporting that, and you'll probably see a good massing of Democratic women in Tallahassee when it's possible that we get a committee hearing on the ERA. We also are very supportive of pro-environment policies. We're taking an active role with the Land Water Legacy Campaign. We're supporting that. And right now we're also just keeping our eye on possible filed legislation that would try to further erode women's reproductive rights in the state of Florida. And we also are – yes.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say, we're also really concerned about what's going to happen with the healthcare exchanges. We think that women's access to healthcare should be a priority in Florida, and we're very concerned that women's access will be limited if our leaders do not open the door to giving us access when the exchanges open and also giving navigators access to the health centers so that women can have informed counsel when they make those decisions about healthcare in the coming months.
Dr. Panto, I was going to ask you, that keeping them out of the clinics, oh, no, never mind letting them back in. Do you think the state's going to be trying a various number of things to obstruct the rollout of the navigators and all that? I mean, clearly they've already feigned in that direction.
Oh, yes. I think we've not seen the last of barriers and obstructionist tactics that are going to come our way, and it's, you know, any monkey wrench they can throw in the works, we can expect to see it in the coming months.
Your work in women's services after rape, we have learned of the terrible, terrible failure of any kind of serious treatment of people in the services, and
yes,
the numbers are staggering, and of course anybody who thinks about it for half a second realizes that what's reported is only a fraction of what's actually going on. Do you think there's any chance the services are going to take this serious?
I think that there are individuals in the service that take this seriously. I think that we have some systemic cultural issues in our military forces, and that it is going to take time for this to change. But the fact that we have got people in the highest levels of power, basically the highest levels of authority, who are actually speaking these words, the first step to addressing a problem is recognizing and naming the problem. And for a long time, rape in the military was something that wasn't spoken about. It was the dirty little backroom secret of the military, and it was something that, you know, I came of age in a time when more women were going to military academies. So women of my generation were the first ones to go to the Citadel and to go to West Point. And the stories they told were at times horrific. And it was, you know, they were the groundbreakers for military service. And then, of course, we saw with the new kinds of modern warfare that we had women who were supposed to be in supporting roles who ended up really being in the front lines of combat. And as we've lifted the combat ban for women in the military, which is supposed to fully be rolled back over the next 2 years, we're going to see these issues being addressed more and more, where we have to actually have commanders who are held accountable, who are setting the cultural tone for the people that they lead, and there has to be real, actual, enforceable consequences for people who commit rape in the military. And then we also have to believe women when they step forward, and we have to make sure that they are provided the appropriate mental and medical health care that they need in the event of suffering a rape.
To extend from Florida politics to the national level, you know, right now, of course, there's this big debate on the best way to help the Syrian population, and maybe secondarily help the refugees to some extent. Do you foresee the Democratic Party setting forth policies that turn their face maybe more toward the refugees than toward the weapons approach to solving this?
I think that the statesmanship level of the discourse on Syria is going to continue for a few more weeks. I was telling the Democratic Progressive Caucus they wanted to do some kind of resolution on Syria for the Democratic State Convention for Florida, and I said, I do not think we're going to be having the same discussion about Syria at the end of October that we're having today. I do think that we are going to shift our focus to refugees. And I will tell you that The United Nations is already, they have boots on the ground in the countries around Syria because people have been streaming over the borders. There are huge refugee camps in all the countries surrounding Syria right now, and whole cities have sprung up in weeks, and they're tent cities, and they have commerce, they have healthcare, what they can provide in these tent cities, and the United Nations is taking an active role, and the nations that are hosting these refugees actually absorbed a lot of people into their communities. The tent cities that have sprung up are when saturation has been met in those communities, and then the tent cities. We're talking about a mass migration of a people across national borders within the last 4 weeks. We're talking thousands. I did hear one estimate that said over 100,000. But that's, I mean, we're talking about populations of cities moving across these borders and setting up new communities without their infrastructure. So all the things we have to think about, medical care, schooling for kids, the safety, the displacement of women and children. I always get worried about trafficking of women and children in these situations because life becomes so much more precarious at that point, and people become vulnerable to this kind of exploitation and victimization.
Thank you. To return to Florida politics, obviously it would be wonderful to see two women candidates and maybe even in the not-too-distant future, a woman governor. Let me ask you about the economic side of things. How can we get some traction on women's pay equity? What are your thoughts, Nannarina?
Oh, gosh. Well, there are a few things that have to happen. One is increasing the number of women who go into the STEM fields. Part of the issue with pay equity is, yes, comparable worth continues to be an issue. Even after Lilly Ledbetter, we still know that women are not always paid the same for the same job. But a larger problem is what's happening in K-12 education and post-secondary education, where we don't have women going into fields that are going to be paying them more after graduation. And the fact that we still have girls who are being told, you don't need to take the hard math class. Science, that hard science class, that's not for you, honey. Don't worry your pretty little head about that. Well, no. Women need to be the engineers and doctors of tomorrow. So until we're actually telling women, yes, your brain is fully capable of doing this, and by the way, math and science are really sexy and you should be taking those majors, then we have to change the culture of how girls think about the STEM fields.
Well, thanks. Aim, any passing final thoughts?
So I also, in my research on you, Dr. Pienta, I saw that you just published a book on women's studies policies. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
I did, Amy. Thank you. I just published, McGraw-Hill does a series called Taking Sides, and they take different topics, and they'll publish a book that takes multiple contemporary controversial issues about one particular topic, and they'll do a chapter book. It's an edited book based on research-based, taken from the news and the current research, and you do pro and con arguments, and you frame and do analysis. And it's a teaching tool mainly for college classrooms. And I had the opportunity to write McGraw-Hill's first book, Clashing Views in Women's Studies, as part of their Taking Sides series. So it's 19 chapters of issues ranging from redefining rape to women's access to abortion to talking about Title IX to talking about women running for office, women's the challenges we face with human trafficking. Again, 19 chapters. But
wow.
So it is actually being used. It's being marketed globally. McGraw-Hill is a major publishing company, and it's being used in college classrooms across the country right now. They were taking pre-orders in the spring, and it's actually in people's hands this fall. And I'm really looking forward to getting some feedback from people across the country as they use it in their classroom and students get to talk about the issues that I've highlighted for them.
That Congratulations.
Is so incredible. Yeah, that's quite incredible. And I just have a question. When you were writing 19 chapters on all of these different issues that affect women, was there any one in particular that maybe, you know, you learned something a little bit more about, or that one issue that you really, you know, focus on, or that you want to see addressed before the others? I don't want to say, like, you know, prioritize them, but was there anything that really stood out to you when you were writing this 19-chapter book?
Well, I'll tell you, it actually started out as 30 chapters, and McGraw-Hill sent it to, over 300 professors across the country and had them do a survey where they rated which topics they most wanted to teach their students about. So that that kind of helped guide my focus for the book, so that it actually was something that was market-tested. I did a lot in this book about women in the workplace and gender equity, and really talking about women's rights overall, and women's rights in healthcare, women's rights in politics, women's rights in the workplace. And then I also briefly dipped my toe into talking about women in popular culture, particularly about women as the producers of versus the subjects of pornography. And that was an interesting chapter to write, I'll have to say.
Wow, yeah, I would imagine. That's interesting. So I know that there's been a lot of, you know, just touching on pop culture and women in pop culture. I'm sure you, if you haven't seen, that you heard about the MTV Awards and the Miley Cyrus, you know, performance, how the next day it was, you know, more views or more Google searches on Miley Cyrus than what was going on in Syria. I mean, how do you even approach that conversation? Because I had such interesting viewpoints from people on Facebook and just in conversations with my friends, you know, that we shouldn't be shaming her for, you know, expressing herself how she chooses. But, however, this also feeds into this, you know, over-sexuality, you know, sexualization of women on TV and almost pornographic, you know, undertones. I was wondering if you had any, you know, what your insights were on that.
Well, first of all, I was watching the MTV Awards that night, so I saw the train wreck unfold. But that said, you know, that's my personal, you know, visceral first gut reaction was, whoa, train wreck, like, I want to have a conversation with Miley. But then from kind of when I stepped back and put on my women's studies hat, I have to say, well, okay, I mean, she's twerking, she's making herself a sexual object, but what did people say about Madonna? What did people say when Britney Spears and Madonna kissed on stage? What about, you know, dating myself? When I was, you know, in school, going to the school dances in the 80s, kids were freaking on the dance floor. And,
yeah.
And adults were scandalized, and they told us not to do it, and they, you know, we got in trouble for it. And I, you know, I said this to some people in a discussion recently, that every generation is going to cast an eye back to the generation coming up after them and be scandalized by it. I mean, we know people who in their teens and their 20s lived kind of wild lives, and they pushed the envelope and they were testing their boundaries. And it is part of the rite of passage to go out there and you start to figure out who you are as a sexual being and figure out what your personal gender identity is. And we used to think that, you know, people with long hair that listened to rock and roll were all drug addict degenerates. And now some of those
right.
people are, you know, they hold public office. So I think we have to remember that we all thought that the generation coming up was a lost generation at one point or another. And basically, I think that people over 30 need to take a deep breath and calm down and remember what they were like in their youth. And hope. But, I mean, and that said, you know, Miley Cyrus might be an extreme example. I hope that Miley Cyrus is just being a normal girl who grew up in the public eye and had a lot of expectations placed on her, who's now breaking free a little bit. And I hope that she's not going to be in Amy Winehouse. I mean, and that's really all I hope for Miley Cyrus, is that she figures out who she is and develops into the strong woman I think she has the potential to be, and that we don't read about her having befalling some tragedy in the news in a few years.
Right. No, I think it's really great. And as women, I think we need to accept accepting and understanding and supportive of other women, whether they're celebrities or people in our personal network. You know, we're in this together. We have such a, you know, we have so many battles to face. I mean, we're fighting to get equal pay, you know, to be treated, you know, as our own individual in the doctor's office, you know. And so it's important that, you know, we stand together. So I really appreciate your insight on it and how, you know, we just hope for the best for Miley and every other young woman that's growing up in this digital world and, you know, hopefully has an eye to the future and maybe even politics.
Dr. Piena.
Exactly. Yes.
I was going to see if I could ask you one more question on a slightly different tack, but also to the extent of popular culture and sexuality and the media that surrounds us, whether it be the Facebooks or the cell phones or pick your poison, whether it be the traffic light that's monitoring, the security cameras everywhere, the loss of privacy. As a professional, both educator and a person dealing with women's rights, what are your thoughts about the ubiquity of surveillance? And what does that say, and how do you coach people dealing with both their sexuality and the face we place toward popular culture in what is now increasingly a surveillance society? What are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, we talk about surveillance society and we start to think sort of Brave New World types of Orwellian sinister sorts of things. Like, but the surveillance society is a double-edged sword. In some ways, it can make the world safer. In other ways, it can invade our privacy. One of the things that I want people to consider is that we submit or even willfully choose a lot of the surveillance that exists. Our cell phones are surveillance devices. They have tracking devices. When you're doing social media, like checking in on Foursquare or even tweeting or you're on Facebook, your location can be charted and you're choosing to do these things. So, and there are all different layers of information gathering. I mean, shoot, the Obama campaign made great use of all the data that was out there because of social media, and they basically used all the data available and used marketing strategies to win a campaign. So there are some really innovative things we can do with this so-called surveillance society. What we need to think about, all right, where does the limit of our safety border, the limit of our privacy and our freedom? And also, if we're a safer society, does that make us more free? In my graduate school days, we used to talk about a cage, a bureaucratic cage, or just a cage of society where culture's rules encaged you. And so if you were going to be a part of a society, you weren't truly free, but you were choosing to enjoy the benefits of that society in exchange for certain compromises on your freedom, because it kept you safer and it made you part of the social fabric. And overall, it created a structure where we were all able to live together. So before we, you know, start freaking out about the NSA, we have to consider what's really happening. And by the way, just because we're talking about the NSA listening in doesn't mean that traffic hasn't been monitored for years and years, and we just didn't understand the extent of it before now.
Yes, when Instant Messenger first came out in the early 90s, I had a family member who was using IM to run a school play back and forth. And literally the Metro Police showed up and said, there's someone talking about suicide. It was a play about teenage suicide.
Right,
and
sure.
The Instant Messenger was monitored back then, and they knew that someone was talking about suicide and came to check it out. So, yeah,
and
it has gone on for a long time. I'm sorry?
But thank goodness for that. On one side, you can say that's horrible, but the other side, you can say, you know, was someone's life saved because they did that?
Well, in this case, it was just a school play.
In this case, it was. But I'm someone who's worked with youth for years, and I know that sometimes a Facebook post is something you should pay attention to.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you both, ladies. Thank you so much, and Trish and Jennifer and Vicky and Laura. All thank you all so much for joining us. And ladies, thank you so much for the work that you do. you make this a better world because of the work that you do. And Dr. Rachel, thank you again for so many. Congratulations on your book and
so
many of your other projects. And good luck with your election. Amy,
thank you
so much for joining me. And
you
all take care. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, folks, and we're going to leave with a little bit of a tune. Which side are you on? Next week.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a son for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? He'll be with you, fellow workers, until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Sing it!
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Oh, workers, can you stand it? Tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab, or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Tell me which side are you on? Which side are you on? Good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Tell me which side are you on?